Last week, I appreciated the sermon that Mr. Jackson gave on the first commandment, and as he mentioned in the sermon that we have discussed about doing a series on the Ten Commandments, so I appreciated him being willing to take that first one and giving the explanation that he did from a biblical point of view as far as what commandments mean, what the word commandment means, and the various aspects that he was able to cover concerning the first commandment. And I just thought I would make mention, this has been a goal of mine for some time, and it's still a work in progress, but after the sermon today, if you want to pick one up, you're welcome to pick up a sheet that's on the information table, and it's going to cover some of the main points of the sermon, and then also at the bottom there's a perforation. You can rip that off and use this as your refrigerator sermon of the week, or use it as a bookmark, a refrigerator scripture, I should say. It's not the whole sermon, it's one scripture. But use it as a bookmark or on your refrigerator or whatever you'd like to do in order to keep some of the main points of today's sermon in mind. As we go forward, I might have it where there's some blanks and just hand it to you beforehand, and you're welcome to use it in tracking notes as well. I've probably talked to you before about one of the wonderful opportunities I had as a young man, where between my junior and senior years in college, I was able to spend a year in Sri Lanka, which is a small island nation off the coast of India. And so I was able to take a full year and teach English as a second language. And it was life-changing for me in many ways. I was in my mid-20s. It was the first time I'd been out of the United States. And when you go to a foreign country, especially one that is third world, there are a number of things that are just very different than America. And of course, almost immediately coming off the plane, at the time we landed in a parking lot. I think it's a terminal now. We just went a few years back. But at the time, when the first time I went, we landed in a big airstrip, and you get off the plane and walk. And the first thing I noticed, of course, was the humidity and the temperature of being that close to the equator. And then some of the smells start to hit you, and you doesn't take long to recognize the differences in the culture of the people and the food and various things of that nature. And one of the first things I noticed, having not traveled much to other parts of the world, was that the country was divided into various sections based upon how it was settled at various times. So some of the first people that came over, you could tell that their religion, the main religion for that section of the country, was Hinduism. Because as you drive around, you'll see, we were able to see various Hindu temples. And if you've seen Hindu temples, if any of you have traveled to various parts of the world where you see some of these, these particular in Sri Lanka were very ornate, where they had various statues that are carved or placed around the temple, and I'm sure Mr. Jackson saw many of the same things in India. And so it was very unusual to look at a place that I would consider a church, and people would go there, and there was their deity with the elephant head and the various arms of a man, and then also the various statues that they would have. And as I looked at this, and even I remember one of the first taxis I got in, the taxi driver was Hindu. And one of the first things he did was, when we told him we wanted to go somewhere, he pulled up to a Hindu temple and got out and gave a little offering at the temple gate. And then he got back in and said a prayer over the steering wheel, and then we took off. And we made it. I didn't attribute it to his prayer, but we made it to where we were going. So these things were just very foreign to me. And I thought in my mind, since I had grown up in God's church, I thought, well, this is what the Bible means about not worshiping idols. Now, surely this is it. But there's another section of the country that is primarily Buddhist. And when you go through this part of the country, you see Buddhas in the roundabouts. They're in the middle of the roundabout. They have sitting Buddhas and standing Buddhas and Buddhas that are lying down. And after I went through that part of the country, I thought, wow, there's just nothing like this in America. Surely this is what the Bible means when it talks about not worshiping idols. But there's another part of the country down along the southern coast where the Portuguese settled. And of course, when the Portuguese came to Sri Lanka, they were Catholic. And all around the southern part of the island, there are crosses and there are statues. And then it struck me. This is what the Bible means by "do not worship idols." And of course, it is all over America as well. Now, these types of idols are everywhere throughout the world in various ways. But it struck me at that time just how accustomed I was to seeing idols and to seeing things that people have carved out into images to one way or another make a part of their worship, that have become a part of their worship. So it is all around us. Well, what does God have to say about this? Because God expects each and every one of us not to become at ease with the customs of the world, not to become at ease with the practices of the world. And it's important that we always keep in mind that God expects us to worship Him in truth and in spirit. In truth and in spirit. Let's turn to Deuteronomy chapter 5 and read the second commandment from Deuteronomy chapter 5. Of course, we're accustomed with the listing of the Ten Commandments in Exodus chapter 20. And here in Deuteronomy chapter 5, they are reviewed and reiterated to the people of Israel. Now, those of you who might be familiar with the Catholic Bible, there is a note in the Catholic Bible that states both the first and second commandment are combined. They're considered the first commandment. And then the tenth commandment is divided into two. So it says you shall not, I think the ninth is you shall not covet your neighbor's goods, and then the tenth is wife, or it might be vice versa. So were you a former Catholic? So somebody's telling me exactly how it's listed back there. But it is, don't covet your neighbor's wife as number nine, and don't covet your neighbor's goods as number ten. So the first two are combined into one, but we understand that they are separate commandments of God. So the second commandment starts in verse 8, where it states, "You shall not make for yourself any carved image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is in the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them nor serve them, for I, the Eternal, your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children to the third and fourth generations of those who hate me, but showing mercy to thousands, to those who love me and keep my commandments." And so we read through this and we see, "You shall not make for yourselves any carved image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is in the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth, and you shall not bow down to them nor serve them." So we recognize that this is a commandment of God that we are commanded to be aware of and to obey. It's an important aspect of worshiping God in truth and in spirit. So the first commandment talks about who we worship. The second commandment talks about how we worship. And Scripture tells us that we worship the true God in truth and in spirit. Now, some of you may have heard of this previously, but I thought I would use it as an example of how common idols can become. There's an article on Snopes, Snopes.com. You might be familiar with it. If somebody sends you something via an email and you're trying to figure out whether or not it's real, you can go to this website and they do some good research and they'll verify whether or not something is real. But one of the sections on this website is about burying statues of St. Joseph's on the property that you're trying to sell. Has anybody heard of this before? Well, it is a very popular custom in the United States. Many realtors believe that it works, I'm going to give you an example of a woman who moved from Maryland to Arizona. We have one, but it's not your name in here, so I know it's not you. But this says that after 8 months of paying the mortgage on her unsold home in Baltimore, not Point of Rocks, but Baltimore, she sent her agent a statute and burial instructions. Within 2 weeks, the house sold. There's another case that's documented, they claim, that involved a couple moving because of a new job. But their house, which was in an active neighborhood, wasn't doing anything, even with St. Joseph in the ground. But they figured out later that St. Joseph's inattention turned out to be for the better because the husband got a better job offer in another state, and that's when their house sold. In 1995, Betsy Moore was determined to sell her house on Lake Avenue in Baltimore at a premium, and she listed it for $15,000 more than any other house in the neighborhood had ever sold. And after 7 quiet months, a friend recommended that she bury a St. Joseph statue. So right after that, the next week, a group of nuns arrived to look at the house, and then shortly after that, the house sold at the highest price ever in that house, or that area, according to the agent. So those trying to sell a home, they feel in need of a miracle, and so they will get a little statuette of St. Joseph, and they bury it in the yard. And there are various ways to bury it. So different ones will say to bury it differently, but one of the things that I read in this article talks about that if you bury it upside down, the house will sell quicker because St. Joseph wants to get out of the ground as fast as possible. So the idea behind it is once the house sells, you're supposed to dig the statuette up, clean it off, and keep it on your mantle for as long as you're in your new home. So the practice of burying a plastic St. Joseph to help speed the sale of a home dates at least to 1979 in the United States. In the 1990s, it became all the rage with realtors buying plastic saint statues by the gross. The standard practice calls for the statue to be dug up once the property has been sold and placed on the mantle, as I mentioned, or in a place of honor. Why St. Joseph, you may ask? Well, he's the patron saint of home and family in the Roman Catholic religion. So it goes through various ways that it's supposed to be buried and different things. And it also goes through a description of a custom home selling kit that realtors provide for people. And in this kit, it includes the statue, a prayer card, and instructions on how to bury it. It concludes with saying that many who have experienced difficulty selling their homes have reported seemingly miraculous sales after burying a statue on their property. There's even a book that was printed or published in 2003 that's replete with stories. One of the articles in the book claims that one man who buried a statue, as he was instructed to in the front of the house, couldn't sell his home, so he dug it up, buried it on the side of the home, as someone else mentioned, didn't sell the house, dug it up, buried it behind the house, exactly as he was given instructions to do, still didn't sell the home, dug it up, threw it in the trash can, opened the newspaper a week later, and read that the local dump had been sold. It's in the book. I'm not making that one up. The reason I read this story is not just to be funny or show the extent to it, but just to point out that it is all around us as far as idols, and they are. It's easy to become accustomed to it. So before we get more into specifically the second commandment, let's turn to Romans chapter 12. Because I want to establish and make sure that we are clear about how God feels with His people mixing with the world. We are, as we know and understand, to come out of the world. So what does God mean by this when He tells us to come out of the world? It's important to understand this. Romans chapter 12, Hopefully these are scriptures that we recognize and that we know. Verse 1 says, I beseech you, therefore, brethren. And remember, anytime you see the word beseech, it is used in order to show that there is greater urgency, or what's going to come after that is of importance. So when Paul says, I beseech you, he's not just saying, I ask this of you, I'm telling this of you. He's saying, pay attention, because this is very important. It's very important to God, and it should be important to us. So I beseech you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable to God, which is your reasonable service. So it says we are to present ourselves holy and acceptable to God, which is our reasonable service. Reasonable means it makes sense, or that it's clear. We should understand this. One translation translates the word reasonable as your spiritual service. And in the Greek, it means being true to your nature. So after conversion, we have God's nature, or a godly nature. So it's saying that that should make sense to us to live our lives this way, that we present our bodies a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God. So it's important to understand what makes us acceptable to God, because it's our responsibility to present ourselves as acceptable to our Creator, acceptable to God. So it's only possible to be viewed as acceptable or pleasing, as it could be translated, to God if we fulfill what's in verse 2. Verse 2 says, and do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove what is that good and acceptable and perfect will of God. Now, I've talked extensively over the past year or so about knowing the will of God. That's something that, as Christians, we desire to know. We want to know what the will of God is. And we recognize that we find God's will based upon truth, based upon Scripture. So let's back up just a little bit here, because in verse 2, it says, do not be conformed to this world. Now, the word conformed means molded or following a pattern, an outward appearance that is the same. So when it talks about being conformed to the world, make sure you understand what this means. Don't just read this and bypass it quickly or go over it fast. Understand what it means, because it's saying don't fall into the same pattern or the same mold as the world. So when you think of a mold, what do you think of? Maybe some of you think of Jell-O. I think of ice cubes, because for a long time we didn't have an ice maker in our fridge. We had ice trays, and so we have it's a mold. You put the water in it freezes. You crack it or whatever you twist it, and they come out, and they all look the same pretty much. They might be a little bit different in size, but they all look the same. So that's what it's talking about. Don't just be conformed. Don't fall into the patterns of the world, but be transformed. Now, the word transformed has the same root as the word metamorphosis, which means a change. It's a change that should be visible to others, but it's referring to a change from the inside out. So that first term is talking about following a pattern or a mold or form like everybody else is doing. But this second word, transformed, it's talking about having a change from the inside out, a change of heart and a change of mind, a change of attitude. So God's Spirit is what allows this kind of change to happen. And the word renewal, Valerie and I were talking about this exactly in English, maybe where it says renewing, some translations will say renewal of your mind. The Greek, it actually means to make it new and different. So it's not just like renewing a library book where you get the same thing, only it's a fresh start or a renew or something like that. It means to make it different with the idea of being superior to the former. So the renewing of our mind means that it should be superior to the former. So it's talking about developing the mind of God. So to be acceptable, to be pleasing to our God, then we are to not be conformed to the world, but transformed spiritually, so that God's ways, God's laws are written in our hearts and in our minds. And it's important that we understand this in relation to the second commandment as well. And so it should be clear to us that we are to stand apart from this world. We are to stand out differently and represent the truth of God, and not ideas or traditions of human beings, especially in regards to false religion. So it's important that we are familiar with God's Word, and it's also good to be familiar with certain traditions that are practiced throughout traditional Christianity. It's important to know what is of God and what is of man. And we're told in various ways and locations in the Bible the importance to God about separating ourselves from the world. I'm just going to refer to 1 John chapter 2, where we're told, "Love not the world, neither the things that are in the world. If any man loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him." So we are to be separate from the world. And God clearly wants us to be alert and aware of what is of the world and what is of God, and to make that distinction. Let's turn also to Ephesians chapter 5. Ephesians chapter 5. Starting in verse 8. "For you were once darkness, but now you are light in the Lord. Walk as children of light. For the fruit of the Spirit is in all goodness, righteousness, and truth, proving what is acceptable to the Lord. And have no fellowship with the unfruitful works of darkness, but rather expose them." So it says, don't have fellowship with the unfruitful works of darkness, because we're no longer a part of it. And it says to expose them. That means to make them clear. It means to reprove or to bring to light. So what we read here, God expects us to measure with what we do and how we worship Him according to His Word. Let's look at one other verse here. 2 Corinthians. 2 Corinthians chapter 6. We've covered this recently, but I do want to look at it again in regards to this. Paul's talking, obviously, to the brethren at that time and to us as well. Verse 14, where it says, "Do not be unequally yoked together with unbelievers. For what fellowship has righteousness with lawlessness? And what communion has light with darkness?" So he makes it very clear, very direct statements about not combining with the world or not being a part of it. Verse 15, "What accord has Christ with Belial?" So that's a false god. "What part has a believer with an unbeliever? And what agreement has the temple of God with idols? For you are the temple of the living God. As God has said, I will dwell in them and walk among them. I will be their God, and they shall be my people." Verse 17, "Therefore, come out from among them and be separate, says the Lord. Do not touch what is unclean, and I will receive you." So it's important in regards to all the commandments, in regards to worshiping God and obeying God, that we recognize what is of God and what is of man. It's interesting to note that idol worship was condemned long before the Ten Commandments. There's an interesting example of this in Genesis 35. Genesis chapter 35. Let's take a look at who in Abraham's family had to deal with idols. Genesis chapter 35. So the point here is that idols were condemned long before the Ten Commandments. Turn back a few pages, should be anyway a few pages, to chapter 31. Let's look here in 31 first. Genesis chapter 31, verse 19. Now Laban had gone to shear his sheep, and Rachel had stolen the household idols that were her father's. And so Rachel, of course, is Jacob's wife, and when Laban, her father, had left, he was taking all of his sheep to have them sheared, as it says here, and Jacob recognized that this was his opportunity to get out of town. So he was gathering up his family, gathering up all of his animals, and he was going to leave. Because Laban had kept him there and used him for a number of years. So he was going to see this as the time that he could get away. Verse 19, though, it says that Rachel had stolen the household idols that were her father's. So for Laban, it was a way of life to have these idols as a part of his household and a part of the family's worship. So she steals them, and then she also lies about them. So this was something that was obviously very important to her. She thought they had to have these when they left. They were very, at the time, very much thinking that the gods could only have power wherever they were. So these idols that were the family idols only had power where they were. So she wanted to take them with them so that their power would be with them. That's what she was thinking. Verse 34, again it says, now Rachel had taken the household items and put them in the camel's saddle, and she sat on them, and Laban searched all about the tent and did not find them. So he rushes out to catch up with them in order to... he used the excuse that he had to get these gods back from them. So he searched all about the tent. He didn't find them. And then she said to her father, let it not displease my lord that I cannot rise before you, for the manner of women is with me. And he searched but did not find the household idols, because she kept them with her camel and was sitting on them, and talked him out of having her get up to search her and to search her camel. So she took off with the household items. And then later, Jacob had to deal with this. Let's turn to chapter 35 now. Because Jacob had to remind all of them to get rid of any idols and to worship the true God as it is appropriate. Chapter 35, verse 1. Then God said to Jacob, arise, go up to Bethel and dwell there, and make an altar there to God, who appeared to you when you fled from the face of Esau, your brother. And Jacob said to his household and to all who were with him, put away the foreign gods that are among you. Purify yourselves, change your garments. Let us arise and go up to Bethel, and I will make an altar there to God, who answered me in the day of my distress, which has been with me in the way which I have gone. So they gave Jacob all the foreign gods. It was all the idols which were in their hands, or their possession, their belongings, all the earrings which were in their ears, and Jacob hid them under the terebinth tree, which was by Shechem. So the point is that he took them all away. He told them, put away the idols. It was so much a part of life, even by that time, that these people who were with Jacob had their idols. That's what they were accustomed to. So they just were conformed to the world around them, to how others around them worshipped. And Jacob said, no, that's not what we're going to do. We're going to worship the true God as He commands us to worship Him. There are a lot of aspects about the second commandment. We can't cover everything, but I do want to go through a little bit of time of a history lesson maybe for some of us, or review for many of us, and just look at some three well-known Christian symbols and talk about them in relationship to the second commandment. Things that we see all around us and which have become commonplace in Christianity. So I'm going to start with the cross, talk about the steeple, and then also talk about the fish symbol as well. So many of you have probably read this book. If you haven't, I'd recommend it to you. It's called Babylon Mystery Religion. And I've had this book for probably 30 or 40 years. I don't know exactly. But if you've never read this book, I would certainly recommend it to you. Many of you will recognize it. You may have it in your libraries as well at your house. But I'm going to start on page 49. Actually, it's page 48 is where I will start and talk a little bit about the origin of the cross and how it became a part of religion. It says on page 48, if the cross is a Christian symbol, it cannot be correctly said that its origin was within Christianity. For in one form or another, it was a sacred symbol long before the Christian era and among many non-Christian people. According to an expository dictionary of New Testament words, the cross originated among the Babylonians of ancient Chaldea. So the ecclesiastical form of a tomb beam cross had its origin in ancient Chaldea, and it was used as the symbol of the god Tammuz. That's spelled T-A-M-M-U-Z. And it was in the shape of what's known as the mystic Tau, which was the initial of his name. The mystic Tau is the cross that you might see with the circle around the top of it. So that's what's known as the mystic Tau. So in that country and in adjacent lands, including Egypt, long before Christianity, in order to increase the prestige of the ecclesiastical system, pagans were received into the churches apart from faith and were permitted largely to retain their pagan signs and symbols. So in other words, what that's saying is, as many of us are aware of, much of what was used to worship as a part of worship for the pagans was just inculcated in what was later known as Christianity in order to appease them. So hence the Tau or the cross in its most frequent form with the cross piece lower was adopted to stand for the cross of Christ. So in any book on Egypt that shows old monuments, it'll show illustrations where they are worshiping and they worship the sun god. There'll be a sun in there, but there's also a lot of these symbols that represents the cross that was for the god Tammuz. There's an illustration in the book. I'm not going to try to hold it up for you to see, but it says, here unchanged for thousands of years, we find among the most sacred hieroglyphics the cross in various forms, but the one known especially as the cross of Egypt or the Tau cross is shaped like the letter T, often with a circle above it. Yet this mystical symbol was not peculiar to this country, but it was reverenced among the Chaldeans, the Phoenicians, the Mexicans, and every ancient people in both hemispheres. So as the cross symbol spread to various nations, its use developed in different ways. Among the Chinese, the cross is acknowledged to be one of the most ancient devices, and it's portrayed upon various temples in China as well. The cross has been a sacred symbol in India for centuries among non-Christian people, and it lists various places where crosses have been found long before Christianity. In Mexico, founded by Voltan in the 9th century before the Christian era, is a heathen temple known as the Temple of the Cross. And there inscribed on the altar slab is a central cross that's 6 feet high by 11 feet in size. The Catholic Encyclopedia includes a photo of this. So they worshipped it as well. And it goes through various religions at various times and how the cross was used long before Christianity. So it goes through the Greeks, it goes through the Babylonians, Chaldeans, Phoenicians, and it says that the Catholic Encyclopedia acknowledges that the sign of the cross, represented in its simplest form by a crossing of two lines at right angles, greatly antedates in both the East and the West the introduction of Christianity. So it goes back to a very remote period of history of human civilization. But since Jesus died on a cross, does this not make it a Christian symbol? So maybe you have heard it put this way before, because I know that sometimes people will say they use a cross specifically to help them remember the sacrifice of Jesus Christ. Well, according to the Bible, we have the Passover that we just observed here recently to remind us of Jesus Christ. So we have the Passover. It's once a year. We have an annual reminder. And we don't focus on the cross, but we focus on his beaten body. And we focus on the blood of Jesus Christ. So the Bible gives us these reminders. And it's symbolized, of course, with the unleavened bread and the wine. And then it's destroyed. So that's what we are to focus on. Now, the article goes on to talk about how Christ did die on a cross, yet there are many kinds of crosses. So in the Catholic Encyclopedia, if you look up the word cross, there'll be pictures of 40 different types of crosses. So if somebody were to wear a cross to symbolize Jesus Christ, which one would they wear? Because the word that's translated cross in the Greek, in the New Testament, it just means a stake, some kind of stake. So we know Christ died on a cross, but we don't know what type. So none of us know for sure what it was, because even with crucifixion, there were various types that were used. So we do have some clues, because it does talk specifically about the sign that was put above his head and things of that nature. But that's all that we know about it. So we don't know even what type of cross that Jesus Christ died on. So as Christians, it's important that we don't focus on this symbol that has become a part of everyday Christianity. It became much more common in Christianity after the conversion, or the so-called conversion, of Constantine. So for those of you who are history buffs, you might remember that Constantine was, he and his soldiers were approaching Rome, and they were about to have this big battle, and they had a custom at the time. They had oracles or the soothsayers, and it was a very common practice where they would cut an animal open, and they would read the entrails, and that was supposed to tell them something. So he wanted to know, should they go into this battle or not? And so they go through this, cutting open the animals, and the Bible refers to it as well. I think it's in Ezekiel where it talks about reading the liver, and that's what it's talking about. It's that kind of thing. So his oracle said, don't go into this battle. Well, he really wanted to fight the battle. And so what he did was, the next day, he gets up and tells everybody, look, I've had a dream, and this dream is much more important than what the oracle said, because God showed me a cross, and that through the sign of the cross, he's going to lead us to victory in the battle. And so they went into battle, and they won, and it was after that time that crosses became very popular in church services and in religion. So it was supposed to have been this big conversion of the Emperor Constantine. Anybody who knows history knows that he wasn't converted. And it was after that time that he killed his wife and some of his children and other people as well. He was a murderer. He wasn't converted in any shape or form as we understand conversion. But he did understand that cross was a part of everyday religion in many religions at the time. And so by saying that that was the symbol that God gave him, or the sign that God gave him, he was able to convince people that it must be okay to go into this battle. And then also he forced everyone to become Christian after that point as well. Well, we understand that we appreciate the death of Jesus Christ, but it's important to recognize that we focus on his life. Let's turn to Romans chapter 5. Oftentimes in my prayers, when I'm thanking God the Father for Jesus Christ, I do thank God for his life as a human being. I do thank God for his death. But I praise God more for the life that Jesus Christ has now, at the right hand of the Father as our intercessor and our mediator. So we are saved by his life. Romans chapter 5. Verse 6 says, "For when we were still without strength, in due time, Christ died for the ungodly. For scarcely for a righteous man will one die, yet perhaps for a good man someone would even dare to die. But God demonstrates his own love toward us, in that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. Much more then, having now been justified by his blood, we shall be saved from wrath through him. For if when we were enemies we were reconciled to God through the death of his Son, much more, having been reconciled, we shall be saved by his life." And so that is the focus, the emphasis at this point in time is on the life of Jesus Christ. And of course, the cross is something that focuses on his death. Let's move on to the second symbol that I want to cover as far as the steeple. If you ask most people who attend churches what a steeple means or what it represents, they probably won't have much of an idea because generations pass, and oftentimes we don't know why we do the things we do. We just do them. But God says, don't be conformed to the world. So again, from the book Babylon Mystery Religion, page 39, says, "Among the ancient nations, not only were statues of the gods and goddesses in human form made, but many objects that had a hidden or mystery meaning were part of heathen worship. An outstanding example of this is seen in the use of the ancient obelisks." And so obelisks were spoken of by one that's in history. It says it's an obelisk 130 feet high that was erected by Queen Semiramis in Babylon. The Bible mentions an obelisk-type image approximately 9 feet in breadth and 90 feet high that people fell down to. So when Nebuchadnezzar had a golden image and the music went off and people were supposed to bow down to it, if you looked at the image or if you read through the description of it, then you recognize that it was an obelisk of some form. So it's an early stronghold of mystery religion. And the use of the obelisk was best known throughout Egypt, and they're still in Egypt. And you can see them if you've traveled around the world. You may have seen some in various places. I know we've seen some that were moved from Egypt in Istanbul and Rome and various places that we've been to. They're in London. Central Park in New York has one that was taken from Egypt. Originally, it was associated with sun worship and a symbol of Baal, which is a title of Nimrod, the mighty hunter that's mentioned in Genesis. So the ancients rejected the knowledge of the true Creator. And they recognized that life, or they believed that life came from the sun. So they rejected the knowledge of the true Creator. And every spring, when the sun would come out and things would get warm, as we see around us right now, flowers are blooming, and birds are singing, and things are growing, and all that type of thing. They thought, well, obviously, the sun gives life. And so it didn't take long before human beings started to look upon the sun as a god, as the great life giver. So to them, the obelisk also pointed towards the sun, pointed towards the sun god. It goes on to say that realizing through the sexual union life was produced. Then the phallus symbol, which represents the male organ of reproduction, was considered, along with the sun, a symbol of life. So these were the beliefs represented by the obelisks. So we recognize that it has a very strange origin. The very same obelisk that once stood at the ancient temple was the center of Egyptian paganism. It now stands before St. Peter's Cathedral. So if any of you have been there in Rome, then you would have seen this obelisk. We had the opportunity to be there at one point, and I don't necessarily remember seeing that, but that's where it is. I'm going to skip a little bit of this and move forward. Well, there's more that we could say about that, but I'm going to leave it at that as far as the representation behind it. But again, if you were to ask the average churchgoer why churches have steeples, how many of them would say that it points to the sun or that it represents the male sexual organ, because that's what gives life? People aren't going to recognize that, but it's important that we don't conform to the world and that we review this history lesson. So is an obelisk in and of itself wrong? I thought I'd take just a moment to answer that question, because the answer is no. It can be a construction type, and of course not far from here we have the Washington Monument that's built to honor George Washington. It's built to honor him, not to worship him. So in the case of the Washington Monument, it's an architectural style. Now I know I've had people tell me that there are various aspects of the Washington Monument that could be used in various senses of worship, but as far as I know, it was just built as a architectural style and not with any worship behind it. It's also important to know that steeples were referred to as astropoles, and Astra was the name of a false goddess, also known as Astarte, Ishtar, Astora, Aphrodite, Venus, and Semiramis. And we should also know that that's the name of the wife of Nimrod. So Astra was the goddess of fertility, or the goddess of love. And again, one of her symbols was the male reproductive organ, or the phallus. So they were nothing more than carved phalluses with this goddess's image on them. And so again, it's just a sick origin that we see that has become a part of something that the world has conformed to without even recognizing and knowing the origin or the reason why. Let's look in Ezekiel for a moment. Ezekiel chapter 8. We have example after example of Israel turning to idolatry, and she quickly adapted the practices of people around her. And we know that God continually sought to entreat them to turn away from false worship. Ezekiel chapter 8, starting in verse 5, this is Ezekiel speaking here, where he says, "Then he said to me, Son of man, lift up your eyes now toward the north. So I lifted my eyes toward the north, and there, north of the altar gate, was this image of jealousy in the entrance. Furthermore, he said to me, Son of man, do you see what they are doing, the great abominations that the house of Israel commits here, to make me go far away from my sanctuary? Now turn again, you will see greater abominations. So he brought me to the door of the courts, and when I looked, there was a hole in the wall. And then he said to me, Son of man, dig into the wall. And when I dug into the wall, there was a door. And he said to me, Go in and see the wicked abominations which they are doing there. So I went in and saw there. every sort of creeping thing, abominable beast, and all the idols of the house of Israel portrayed all around on the walls. So we see here that Israel had completely disobeyed the second commandment, and they had made idols of all kinds of things, animals, as it says, every sort of creeping thing, abominable beasts, things that they just made up as well. And so they had all these idols portrayed on the walls. But going back to verse 5, where it says, "And there north of the altar gate was this image of jealousy." Some commentary, so I'm going to quote specifically from the New Bible commentary. It says that this image was roused God to jealousy. More than likely was an image of the Canaanite goddess Ashtoreth. So it would have been a phallus symbol or an obelisk. So that's what they're saying because of the religions that were around them at the time. But it was such an offense to God. You'll notice that it says in verse 6 that these things make me go far away from my sanctuary. So today we understand that we are the temple of God, as we read in Corinthians earlier. So it's important that we don't incorporate man's way of worship into worshiping the true God. Because God says he's against it, and it makes him go far away from his temple. So it's important that we recognize this and that we don't become conformed to the world. Let's also note 1 Kings chapter 14. Now, I thought I would cover this symbol. I've been to many of your homes, and I've not seen any of you have a steeple on your house. But the point that I'm making is how easily it becomes a part of worship. Even the cross that we see all around us, and we see steeples all around us. And it just becomes such a custom that it's easy to see these things, and they become inculcated into what people believe is worship. And yet God tells us, do not become conformed. Don't just follow the pattern of the world. 1 Kings chapter 14, verse 14. "Moreover, the Eternal will raise up for himself a king over Israel who shall cut off the house of Jeroboam. This is the day. What even now? For the Eternal will strike Israel as a reed is shaken in the water. He will uproot Israel from this good land which he gave to their fathers and will scatter them beyond the river because they have made their wooden images, provoking the Eternal to anger." Verse 16, "And he will give up Israel because of the sins of Jeroboam who sinned and made Israel sin." And so we see that the sins of Jeroboam was idolatry and false worship. Verse 22. "Now Judah," same chapter, verse 22. "Now Judah did evil in the sight of the Eternal, and they provoked him to jealousy with their sins which they committed, more than all that their fathers had done. For they also built for themselves high places, sacred pillars, and wooden images on every high hill and under every green tree. And there were also perverted persons in the land. They did according to all the abominations of the nations which the Eternal had cast out before the children of Israel." And so it was very common to put obelisks or phalluses on the highest hills. They called them high places so that they would get as close to the sun as possible. And we see that it makes God angry. It's obvious. He's not pleased. So it's important that we recognize what's going on around us and that we don't become accustomed or conformed to worshiping as the world does. So let's move on to one last Christian symbol, and that is the fish and a little bit of its history. Driving around in various places that we've lived, we lived in Colorado Springs for a while, and maybe some of you are familiar with Dr. Dobson and Focus on the Family. His headquarters are there, and there's many cars that have bumper stickers or the fish symbol that's connected to the back of their car. Now, in Maryland, I've seen some of those symbols that are on the cars, but I've also seen the dinosaur that's eating the fish symbol. Have you all seen that? It represents evolution. But I've seen that on several cars around the Frederick area. I'm going to read this from, instead of the book I was reading from earlier, it's from the Religious Tolerance website. The purpose of this website is to talk about various religions so you can have an understanding of them and be accepting of them. So it says, the pre-Christian history of the fish symbol. The fish symbol has been used for millennia worldwide as a religious symbol associated with the pagan Great Mother Goddess. And it's the outline of her vulva. So the fish symbol was often drawn by overlapping two very thin crescent moons. One represented the crescent shortly before the new moon, and the other shortly after. And the moon is the heavenly body that has long been associated with the goddess. So the sun is a symbol of God, and the moon the symbol of the goddess. So the link between the goddess and fish was found in various areas of the ancient world. So in China, the great mother Kuan Yin is portrayed in the shape of a fish. In India, the goddess Kali was called the fish-eyed one. In Egypt, Isis was called the great fish of the abyss. And in Greece, the Greek word Delphos meant both fish and womb. So what we find is that, again, the fish is a part of the fertility symbol. In ancient Rome, Friday is called Dies Vernis, or the Day of Venus, the pagan goddess of love. And throughout the Mediterranean, mystery religions used fish, wine, and bread for their sacramental meals. And so it goes through also various goddesses from Scandinavia, from the Middle East, and various places, and that the fish symbol was so revered throughout the Roman Empire that Christian authorities insisted on taking it over, with extensive revisions of myths to deny its earlier female genital meanings. So the symbol itself and the eating of fish on Friday and the association of the symbol with the deities, the goddesses, were all taken over by the early church from pagan sources. And so what we find is that, again, the use of the fish symbol comes from paganism. Although it's used today, this is still words from this website. It says, although it's used today, is considered by most not to have anything to do with paganism, we can see that its beginnings are no different than other pagan symbols. One of the quotes on this website states this, the fish outline is a logical symbol for the early Christian church to adopt, because fish played a major role in the Gospels as fishermen were called to be disciples. And later these men were called to be fishers of men. And so they just make it a transition from the pagan origins to why it can be symbols of Christianity today. So again, the language that's used is to get people used to mixing a little bit of truth with the paganism. And we've seen from the scripture that God does not want us to mix with darkness. He does not want the holy to mix with the unholy in any way. Now let's look at Ezekiel 34, just to reiterate this fact. Ezekiel 34. Verse 10, and he said, behold, I make a covenant before all your people. I will do no marvels such as have not been done in all the earth, nor in any nation, and all the people among whom you are shall see the work of the Eternal, for it is an awesome thing that I will do with you. Observe what I command you this day. Behold, I am driving out from before you the Amorite and the Canaanite and the Hittite, the Perizzite, the Hivite, and the Jebusite. Take heed to yourself, lest you make a covenant with the inhabitants of the land where you are going, lest it be a snare in your midst. But you shall destroy their altars, break their sacred pillars, and cut down their wooden images. For you shall worship no other God, for the Eternal, whose name is Jealous, is a jealous God. And so we see, again, that God makes it very clear. He made it very clear to ancient Israel. He did not want them to conform to the world around them. And as soon as they were accepting of other people's religions, they began to accept it. They began to mix in paganism with the way that God taught them to worship, or the way that God told them to worship. So it's important to remember that Satan, our enemy, he disguises himself. He disguises himself as an angel of light so that he can deceive more people, and he can incorporate the paganism with the way that God says to worship. So the first commandment deals with who we worship. The second commandment deals with how we worship. And always remember that God tells us how to worship Him. So let's conclude in John chapter 4. John chapter 4, just a couple of verses here. Verse 23 tells us, "But the hour is coming, and now is, when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and in truth. For the Father is seeking such to worship Him." Verse 24, "God is spirit, and those who worship Him must worship in spirit and in truth." So God gives us the truth. If we obey the truth, if we obey Him, He gives us His Spirit. And this is what allows us to worship Him as it pleases Him. This is what allows us to be acceptable in God's sight.